my chance for crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven the middle of it. Grass makes heaven the middle. We are grass makes heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to start off here this evening and cover the Mueller testimony to Congress that took place this last Wednesday, and we're going to make some very important assertions here, and focus in on some very important interviews. Gohmert from Texas, U.S. Representative Gohmert, made one of the most important interviews, I think, during the questioning of Mueller. So here we go now with some very scathing attack like mode of people, but Gohmert, I'm going to start off with his questioning because I think it's one of the most important. Here we go now with Gohmert.
Credibility, and maybe you've been away from the courtroom for a while. Credibility is always relevant. It's always material, and that goes for you, too. You're a witness before us. Let me ask you, when you talked to President Trump the day before he appointed you, or you were appointed as special counsel, you were talking to him about FBI director position again. Did he mention the firing of James Comey?
Not as a candidate. I was asked.
Did he mention the firing of James Comey in your discussion with him?
Cannot remember.
Pardon?
Cannot remember. Don't believe so, but I'm not going to be specific.
You don't remember. But if he did, you could have been a fact witness as to the president's comments and state of mind on firing James Comey.
I suppose that's possible.
Yeah. So most prosecutors want to make sure there's no appearance of impropriety. But in your case, you hired a bunch of people that did not like the president. Let me ask you, when did you first learn of Peter Strzok's animus toward Donald Trump?
In the summer of 2017.
You didn't know before he was hired?
I'm sorry? What did you...
You didn't know before he was hired for your team?
Know what?
Peter Strzok hated Trump.
Okay.
You didn't know that before he was made part of your team. Is that what you're saying?
I did not know that.
All right. When did you first learn?
When he did find out, I acted swiftly to have him reassigned elsewhere in the FBI.
Well, there's some discussion about how swift that was. But when did you learn of the ongoing affair he was having with Lisa Page?
About the same time I heard from Strzok.
Did you ever order anybody to investigate the deletion of all of their texts off of their government phones?
Once we found that Peter Strzok was an author of...
You're not answering my question. Did you order an investigation into deletion and reformatting of their government phones?
No, there was an IG investigation ongoing.
Well, listen, regarding collusion or conspiracy, you didn't find evidence of any agreement, I'm quoting you, among the Trump campaign officials and any Russia-linked individuals to interfere with our U.S. election, correct?
Correct.
So you also note in the report that an element of any of those obstructions you referenced requires a corrupt state of mind, correct?
Corrupt intent, correct.
Right. And if somebody knows they did not conspire with anybody from Russia to affect the election, and they see the big Justice Department with people that hate that person coming after him, and then a special counsel appointed who hires dozen or more people that hate that person, and he knows he's innocent, He's not corruptly acting in order to see that justice is done. What he's doing is not obstructing justice. He is pursuing justice. And the fact that you ran it out 2 years means you perpetuated injustice.
I take your question.
The time has expired. The witness may answer the question.
I take your question.
Coming up next is Jim Jordan questioning Mueller. And he talked about all these people that were charged with crimes, processed crimes primarily about lying, you know, to the FBI or whatever during interviews. So they perjured themselves. So there's a lot of those out there, but this is what Jim Jordan said about one of the most important people that was interviewed and caught lying. So see what you think about this.
And when the FBI interviews him, he lies three times. And yet you don't charge him with a crime. You charge Rick Gates for false statements. You charge Paul Manafort for false statements. You charge Michael Cohen with false statements. You charge Michael Flynn, a three-star general, with false statements. But the guy who puts the country through this whole saga, starts it all for 3 years we've lived this now, he lies, and you guys don't charge him. And I'm curious as to why.
Well, we can't get into it, and it's obvious, I think, that we can't get into charging decisions.
When the FBI interviewed him in February, FBI interviews him in February, when the special counsel's office interviewed Mifsud, did he lie to you guys, too?
Can't get into that.
Did you interview Mifsud?
Can't get into that.
Is Mifsud Western intelligence or Russian intelligence?
Can't get into that.
A lot of things you can't get into. What's interesting, you can charge 13 Russians no one's ever heard of, no one's ever seen. No one's ever going to hear of them. No one's ever going to see them. You can charge them. You can charge all kinds of people who are around the president with false statements. But the guy who launches the guy who puts this whole story in motion, you can't charge him. I think that's amazing.
I'm not certain I agree with your characterizations.
Well, I'm reading from your report. Mifsud told Papadopoulos. Papadopoulos tells the diplomat. The diplomat tells the FBI. The FBI opens the investigation July 31st, 2016. And here we are 3 years later, July of 2019. The country's been put through this. And the central figure who launches it all lies to us. And you guys don't hunt him down and interview him again. And you don't charge him with a crime. Now, here's the good news. Here's the good news. The president was falsely accused of conspiracy. The FBI does a 10-month investigation. And James Comey, when we deposed him a year ago, told us at that point they had nothing. You do a 22-month investigation. At the end of that 22 months, you find no conspiracy. And what's the Democrats want to do? They want to keep investigating. They want to keep going. Maybe a better course of action is to figure out how the false accusation started. Maybe it's to go back and actually figure out why Joseph Mifsud was lying to the FBI. And here's the good news. Here's the good news. That's exactly what Bill Barr's doing. And thank goodness for that. That's exactly what the Attorney General and John Durham are doing. They're going to find out why we went through this three-year saga and get to the bottom of it.
Time of the gentleman has expired. In a moment, we will take a very brief...
Okay, now that was quite an exchange, was it not? I need some interpretation and analysis from Judge Napolitano.
Okay, so Joseph Mifsud, the person that Jim Jordan, whose voice you heard, was claiming lied to the FBI, is a professor in Europe who many believe is an American intelligence asset. He's the one that runs into George Papadopoulos in a bar and says, by the way... do you know that the Russians have all this dirt on Hillary? You work for the Trump campaign. Maybe they should know about that. And that is what starts the whole thing rolling. Apparently, when Mueller's people interviewed Professor Mifsud, he misled them on certain things. And Jim Jordan is saying, you indicted Roger Stone. You indicted this one. You indicted that one. Why didn't you indict this guy? Answer, we're not allowed to discuss why we don't charge. Sub Rosa, we didn't charge the president. You don't want us to talk about that because the rules say we don't talk about why we don't charge. So Jim Jordan was making a very good point that the whole thing started by a professor who probably was an intelligence asset and wanted to get this started, and you won't explain this to us.
That's what the Republicans wanted to get into.
Precisely.
How did this thing start?
Precisely.
On whose word?
They will get into it, but not in this forum and not through Bob Mueller, but through the inspector general and the fellow that Jim Jordan referred to, Durham, who's the U.S. attorney with the power to indict those who lied and started the investigation.
This next clip is important because this was a press conference that Pelosi and her cohorts had after the Mueller hearing was over with. And what they said there was all these plaudits about freedom and democracy and protecting our national security and everything else. But some of the most important points, I have two clips here, and are that she's going to continue to go after Trump on a personal basis, on his business, and they're going to continue to subpoena everyone that they can. They've already subpoenaed Ivanka Trump and her husband, Jared Kushner. But that whether that's going to be successful or not, we don't know. But these are ongoing, you could say, complications that are being promulgated to continue to subpoena the subpoena power that Congress has to bring into their question, their star chamber, you could say, interrogation techniques. So here we go next with what Pelosi said at this press conference. There's two different clips.
Acknowledge the greatness of our chair, Jerry Nadler and Adam Schiff. I also want to acknowledge the greatness of Elijah Cummings, the chair of the Government Reform and Oversight Committee. He has really won the first case, the Mazur decision, which his research enabled us to take to court. We won the case. The decision was a complete, beautiful statement on the ability of Congress to have oversight.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Just a remarkable decision. And now, of course, the administration is appealing it. But I thank you, to Mr. Cummings, for your great leadership and where we're going next. Because, as you know, the Mueller investigation could not do the president's personal or business connections. And one of those connections could be to the Russians. And that's what we want to find out. So as we go to questions, I just want to say that I do believe that what we saw today was a very strong manifestation, in fact, some would even say indictment, of this administration's cone of silence and their cover-up. This is about the oath we take to protect and defend the Constitution. But some of the actions that the administration may have taken, we'll see through our investigation, may have jeopardized our national security by strengthening Russia's hand and interfering in our elections, undermining democracy, not only in our country, but in other countries as well, upsetting our preeminence as a democracy in the world. This is very serious.
When Pelosi and them talk about national security, they have forgotten about Hillary's email server that had gross violations of national security and very highly classified information on board those computers that were housed in her own home. So, I mean, it's so hypocritical to hear that. And then they're not going to stop. Just like she said just a few minutes ago, they're going to drill down to his personal affairs and his business connections. And she said there may be a connection to Russia in there. So this is diabolical play by the Democrats. This is undermining their own political party at this time. And then for months they said there was no crisis on the border, and now everyone in America knows there's a crisis. So that position right there was a very, very poor position to take. This is a final clip from the press conference after the Mueller press conference held by the Democrats. Here we go now with Pelosi and gang.
Let me just say this. You give me the opportunity to say this, and then I invite my chairman to close. We want to have the strongest possible case to make a decision as to what path we will go down, and that is not endless in terms of time or endless in terms of the information that we want. But if it comes to a point where the cone of silence and the obstruction of justice and the cover-up in the White House prevents us from getting that information, that will not prevent us from going forward. In fact, it's even more grounds to go forward. My colleagues?
I just want to just echo that. You know, Martin Luther King said something that is in the DNA of every cell in my brain, particularly right now. He said, there comes a point when silence becomes betrayal. And we refuse to betray generations yet unborn and the American people. We're not going to portray them. And the more we're accumulating information and doing the best we can. Again, with a force as great, I don't know how many lawyers the president has, but he's got a lot of them. And they go against every single thing we do. And so, again, we're not going to betray America. We're going to do our part to make sure that we have a democracy that's intact.
Jerry?
The United States is a democracy. It must remain a democracy. A democracy acts through the elected officials with the consent of the people. The people cannot give that consent unless they know the facts. Today was a watershed day in telling the facts to the American people. With those facts, we can proceed. And we face a time of great danger. Richard Nixon said he thought that the president was a dictator. He said if the president does it, that means it's not illegal. President Trump echoed that yesterday. He said under Article 2, I, that is he, can do anything I want. That is a totalitarian picture, not a democratic picture. The United States must be saved from this. So we have to paint the picture of what's going on, a picture of someone who gladly accepted help from a foreign power interested in subverting our election, our democratic election process, and that's what it is, subverting our election process and taking the choice of our president to some extent away from the American people. That's what the Russians attempted to do, and that's what the Trump campaign welcomed them in doing. A president who engages in crimes, repeated crimes, to cover up these unpatriotic and dictatorial actions. And this cannot go on, and it's up to Congress to safeguard the Constitution, and we will do it.
As I mentioned today during our hearing, I think the story of the 2016 election is really a story of disloyalty to country, about greed and about lies. And if there's anything that I think symbolizes those three strands of the 2016 election, it was Moscow Trump Tower. It was this massive real estate project that the president was trying to consummate while he was running for president and concealing it from the country. This, I think, demonstrated disloyalty to the country by deceiving the American people about this massive business opportunity he was seeking while he was running for president. It's certainly a vivid example of the greed of people involved with that campaign, and an ample demonstration of all the lies that permeated the campaign and its aftermath. That, to me, is the story of the 2016 election. We need to make sure that is not the story of the 2020 election. And I'll say this on the issue of impeachment, which I view in very much the same way as the speaker. Maybe I'm just an old prosecutor, but before I brought a case to indictment, I wanted to make sure that I had the strongest evidence possible. I wanted to understand my case. I wanted to be able to make my case. Now, I tried an impeachment case in the Senate about 10 years ago, a corrupt federal judge who was convicted. So I have some understanding of what it takes to get a conviction in the Senate, and I have no illusions about getting a conviction in the Senate. But there are two juries in an impeachment. There is the jury, which is the Senate, which decides removal from office, and then there is the jury that is the American people. And I'm most concerned about the jury that is the American people. And before we embark on a course as significant to the country as the impeachment of a president, I want to make sure that we can make that case to the jury of the American people.
One of the guidelines, and I thank our distinguished chairman, so proud of all of them, but just following up on the last statement by Chairman Schiff, e pluribus unum, that's the guidance our founders gave us. They couldn't imagine how many we would be or how different we'd be from each other. They want us to remember that we are one. So when we go down this path, we want it to be as unifying for our country, not dividing. And that's why we want it to be the strongest possible case. President Lincoln said, public sentiment is everything. Well, in order for the public to have the sentiment, the public has to know. So I hope you will be messengers of the truth to the public. We think today was really a milestone in making that that sentiment be more informed. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
The Democrats have completely forgotten about Uranium One, which today Russia has full ownership of Uranium One. It originated as a Canadian company, and it was given uranium rights in this country, and eventually it attained 50% ownership in two very important, very high ore uranium ore mines in Kazakhstan. All this was happening during the Obama administration. Biden went on recently a television program there, these women on there, The View, and he was talking about there was never a whisper of scandal during the 8 years that he was vice president along with Obama. There were dozens, virtually dozens of scandals, and Uranium One was one of the worst ones. There was the email problem, a scandal. And also, we can't forget what they did to Libya, what Obama and Hillary as Secretary of State did to Libya. And Benghazi, that was betrayal of our ambassador to Libya also. Today, they have slave auctions in Libya. There's two factions fighting for control, political control, military control of Libya, and it's a total trashed out mess. Syria was destroyed, widespread destruction. Many of the Christians died over there. They're finally beginning to rebuild and stabilize now because Russia came in. And also, Trump did originally go, he took the bait on those gas attacks over there, which had proven to be false flag operations. So here we go with all kinds of different problems under the 8 years that Obama was president. And it was a total disaster, to say the least. Next, we have Lou Dobbs, and towards the end of this, he interviews Dan Patrick, Lieutenant Governor of Texas, and they set out some of the accomplishments that they've been able to attain during this tumultuous border crisis, and it is a crisis. And if the Democrats don't get in and help fund, and they've only recently done that on this two-year funding, so but neither party could get caught into a trap of not authorizing money, and they went overboard on that also. But Lou Dobbs has some very, very good things to say about the stopping of some of the drug trade and the drug wars ongoing, and then Dan Patrick tells in detail what Texas' part has been in trying to take care of this immigration problem. So here we go now with Lou Dobbs.
Dramatic moments on the high seas caught on video of the Coast Guard giving chase to drug smugglers who were tossing bales of cocaine overboard as they tried to make their escape in the eastern Pacific. This part of a series of recent cocaine busts. 13 tons of cocaine seized. That's worth about $350 million. Look at that. And they're pitching it overboard and trying to do whatever they can. And the Coast Guard wins. A lovely sight indeed. A former Mexican police officer has been accused of trafficking enough fentanyl into the United States, enough to kill more than 10 million people. Federal prosecutors in Texas indicting 30-year-old Asmir Contreras Martinez today, possessing 33 kilograms of fentanyl in his car. Contreras Martinez, in the country illegally, by the way, he was paid, authorities say, $6,000 to take all of that fentanyl into the United States, taking the drugs from California to Florida. That was the plan. Prosecutors haven't revealed where he got the drugs or to whom, of course, he was going to deliver them. Joining us tonight from the great state of Texas is the state's Lieutenant Governor, Dan Patrick. Governor, good to have you with us, Dan. It is always a pleasure to have you on the show. And Texas has got it moving. You're at the nexus of so much, whether it's economic, whether it is societal, whether it is the border, illegal immigration, and unfortunately, our war on drugs.
Yes. Lou, always great to be with you, and welcome back. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you.
Let me tell you something, Lou. I think today potentially is the biggest day in advancement of border security this century. Well, I realize that's only 19 years and a few months, but in modern times that we've been dealing with this border crisis, today is the biggest day. Two big events happened, Lou. Let's start with the latest one. And I haven't had a chance to read the full opinion because it literally was breaking as I came into the studio. But the Supreme Court ruled that Donald Trump can use military funding to build the wall.
And that is obviously critical. The wall will be built.
Critical.
And the radical Dems, with all of their lying, their viciousness, their hate, it looks like they're not going to be able to block this because the law is on this president's side. He is on the side of law and this Constitution and this country. The Democrats have a very difficult threshold to overcome. I believe now, because he is winning at every level.
Yes.
Do you agree?
And Lou, think about this. $2.5 billion, I agree. And $2.5 billion, Lou, around $10 million a mile, it can be a little less, it can be a little more. I think the president will negotiate an even better deal. But let's just say it's 250 miles for that $2.5 billion. In Texas, that's about what we need to really go forward and secure the border from Brownsville on the Gulf Coast all the way to an area called Falcon Lake up near Laredo.
Right.
If we can get all of those funds or much of those funds, we can pretty much put up a wall across that area or these big barriers.
Right.
The second thing, and Lou, what you said is so right on. He wanted to build a wall. The Democrats have put up a wall to block him. He found a way to go around them. And now this is such a major decision. The second thing today, the third-party agreement with Guatemala that some media had reported, not Fox, but some media said it was a dead deal, that their Supreme Court had said they couldn't do that. Well,
they weren't paying attention to the president.
Now, what does that mean? That means that people coming from Honduras and Nicaragua, since now this is a third-party country, that's where they have to ask for asylum.
Right.
They can't come to our country and ask for asylum. Now, some will try to get around it, obviously, but this will stop them in Guatemala. And Lou, that's where most of our people are coming from, including Guatemala, but from Central America. That's where most of the people are coming. So this now means we can send them, if they get here and they're from Honduras, Nicaragua, or anywhere south of Guatemala, we can send them right back to Guatemala. Obviously, the president carved out a very lucrative deal, in my view, with the Guatemalan government, where they have 60% of the people in poverty, Honduras 65% in poverty. So I'm sure they put this deal together, and you add that to the threat of tariffs on Mexico, and since they pulled the tariffs back and Mexico yielded and they put 6,000 troops on their southern border with Guatemala and helping us on the northern border, our apprehensions have been down about 25% in May and in June. So this significant developments just today added with the Mexico help, we may see a dramatic reduction in apprehensions. And Lou, if that happens, I think he's going to win next year anyway, but he'll win by a landslide.
He's got the wall, he's got the economy, he's got foreign policy, he's got the American people. And people in this country understand right now what they're watching across the span, the horizon of left-wing fake news in this country is pure bull. The polls, as he points out occasionally, when they say 43% or 46%, whatever, you know, you can add another 10-20% to that. Because we saw the very same effect, the Trump effect, in 2016. And it's going on now. I think that this president right now is already a historic, as I've said on this broadcast for some time now, a historic president because of what he's achieved. But with today's victories and this week's victories, Mueller turns out to be exactly what we thought he was, a partisan hack.
You know, I'm offended, by the way, Lou, on that. When they, you know what the Democrats said? Well, he's 74. Excuse me? I know a lot of very sharp people, including the man in the Oval Office, who are in their 70s and very sharp. I mean, I thought, well, he's 74. Let me tell you something, Lou. I'm involved as a lieutenant governor with people who seek appointments.
Who's 74?
For various ambassadorships or positions.
Wait a minute, Dan. Who's 74?
Pardon?
Who's 74?
Mueller.
I just want to make sure.
Well, you know, they said, well, he's 74, so that was a reason for his forgetfulness.
The president is much younger than that. I just wanted to point that out.
With appointments to the White House.
You got it.
And what happened with the real question, Lou, that caught my attention, they said the Democrats meant it as a positive question to make him look fair and balanced that he supports Republicans.
Look,
they said, who appointed you to U.S. attorney? Do you remember that question?
Yeah.
He didn't know.
Well, the great news is,
when you get an appointment from the President of the United States,
as bad as Mueller looked, Gerald Nadler, Adam Schiff, and their cronies in the party of hate looked even worse. And everything they do from here on, it is clearly established. They're card-carrying members of the party of hate.
So what Lou and them were saying was that, number one, the money coming from the Pentagon can go to build the wall. And he said that that will effectively enable them to build it from about Brownsville up to about Falcon Lake on the border. And a lot of people are coming through over that Rio Grande Valley area, which is ripe, open. You know, you can walk across the river almost in places down there. And so it's wide open. We've got Alex Jones coming up with a warning from the severe left, the extreme left, about fomenting a armed revolution. So here we go with Alex Jones.
It's been said a billion times or more, because it's true. Those that do not know history are doomed to repeat it. There's a very important report, a story, a history lesson by Peggy Noonan from the Wall Street Journal dealing with the French Revolution and the Jacobins and pointing out the parallels between what happened during the original Red Terror and what is now happening here in America. Now, anyone who's listened to my broadcast over the years or heard Lord Monckton or others on would understand that Peggy Noonan's report actually only scratches the surface. Why she behaves like she has discovered the parallels between the Jacobins and the French Revolution, and that this is an epiphany that she's sharing with us. Now, I'm not saying that she's plagiarizing history. Again, I'm thankful that she's pointing out this key. But it is a little frustrating because it's basically baby food compared to steak and potatoes. The French Revolution was executed and carried out by agents of Adam Weishaupt and the Illuminati. That's mainline history. They were anti-Christian. They were anti-family. They wanted to get rid of the roles of mother and father. They wanted to get rid of the regular calendar. They wanted to change the days of the week to 9 or 10 days. Now, all of this is in an article. And she parallels it with the modern universities and all their new pronouns and saying, don't say America, don't say American. And she goes, it's crazy that history's repeating itself or that history's hiccuping. No, the truth is that the Jacobin Illuminati Revolution and that nightmare system that killed so many hundreds of thousands of innocent people there was then kicked off again by V.I. Lenin in Russia, where they again targeted the family, attempted to destroy the original agrarian farming societies that enrage the Illuminati, because they want to overthrow the kings, the church, to set up their own system, and they're most threatened by the family and by rugged agrarian individualists that they can't control. They're worried about self-sufficiency, and they know that any centralized system they set up will end up being defeated by the rural communities once they discover how corrupt and bad it is. So what the establishment calls this is the final revolution. So whether it's the Jacobins in the late 1880s, or whether it is V.I. Lenin and the Bolshevik Revolution, or Joseph Stalin, or Mao Zedong and the Cultural Revolution, and the Great Leap Forward, it's all the exact same garbage. And on the surface, they claim that they're atheist. They claim that they don't believe in God, that they are, quote, school teachers. They are schoolmasters. They are the university professors. That's who led the French Revolution. But their own internal documents have been made public. They actually intend to set themselves up as absolute God. So if they can take over the libraries worldwide in all Western countries and have children brought to fat men in clown outfits to be set on their laps, it's an act of psychological rape, an act of domination, an act of saying that there aren't two sexes, an act of making you submit to their insanity. It's cult brainwashing. There was a big article up on InfoWars.com yesterday out of Estonia, which is totally run by George Soros now. Estonia is constantly asking the U.S. to go to war with Russia. There they indoctrinate all the youth into the so-called gay pride events, and they mandatorily take the public school children to the famous art houses there where there's classical art of the family together and of men and women in strong roles. And a huge fat goblin woman hangs signs over that saying, "This is bad, I am good." Then she unveils herself with giant rolls of fat and begins saying obscene things about sex with huge artificial vaginas and bodies and dildos piled up all around her. And when the children try to turn away, she moves in with her goblin form like Baron Harkonnen and demands that they worship her. You can see the look of sickening domination and rape as she's psychically raping and feeding off of them. And as her other lesbian lieutenants look on with extreme pleasure as the young males are made to worship the obscenity. Why is it the same here, the same in Europe, the same all over? Because this is lesser magic. These people are into the occult. And if they can openly unclothe themselves in front of your children, then it will normalize it just like John Podesta's brother, Tony Podesta, in 2007 was in the Washington Post, and he said, "I'm into deviant art. I have a basement." And he showed them photos, the Washington Post, of chained up little three-year-olds being tortured and being raped. But he said, "This is art." And the media fetishized it and posted it and celebrated it, that they were showing what they're doing to everyone in plain view, and there's nothing you can do to stop them. This is called lesser magic, and this is the foundations of the grand grimoires and all the things that the satanic church and the rest of it is established in today. That at the bottom of the rat hole is the ritual abuse of children, as we now all know. And as more of it breaks every day. And so you're seeing them try to psychically and spiritually dominate us and announce, "We kill babies after they're born. We keep them comfortable." You're seeing all the other announcements when we go out to leftist events where they come up and go, "I don't like these little kids. I don't like hearing their little voices." That's the demons letting you know that they are in control and in command, hoping you just give up by sheer fear or hopelessness. The truth is they're beginning to lose their power. It's going to get worse before it gets better, but I challenge you to go read the article linked up on the left-hand side of drudgereport.com. We're going to link it up on InfoWars.com as well. I did a lot of reports on this over the years, but you can't find them on YouTube because my name is unsearchable, basically. But I'm going to have Lord Monckton, who's former chief advisor to Margaret Thatcher and quite the historian, on to break down the Jacobins, the roots of the modern Communist Party, Antifa, globalism, the New World Order. But he'll explain, of course, that it goes back further than that to the legalists and others that were in ancient China. And they create lots of little word rules and lots of little things you've got to follow, or you get imprisoned and or executed. And so we're going to be breaking this down because historically it's important to get this back on the public record so people understand that this is all by design.
This is important history to take note of, and the legalists in China are important to drill down into. Next, we're going to have Boris Johnson, newly elected Prime Minister of UK, speak outside of 10 Downing Street. And then we're going to end the program this evening with his address to the to Parliament, but we won't have time for all of it, but we'll have a click off on our site. So come into thesecrettruth.com and you'll be able to hear the whole speech to Parliament by Boris Johnson, new Prime Minister of UK. Here we go with Boris Johnson outside of 10 Downing Street, the official residency of the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
Happening now, the new Prime Minister of Great Britain, Boris Johnson, addressing the crowd in front of 10 Downing Street. Listen in, because he speaks in the same way as our president. Watch this.
He invited me to form a government, and I have accepted. I pay tribute to the fortitude and patience of my predecessor and her deep sense of public service. But in spite of all her efforts, it has become clear that there are pessimists at home and abroad who think, after 3 years of indecision, that this country has become a prisoner to the old arguments of 2016. And in this home of democracy, we are incapable of honouring a democratic mandate. And so I am standing before you today to tell you, the British people, that those critics are wrong. The doubters, the doomsters, the gloomsters, they are going to get it wrong again. The people who bet against Britain are going to lose their shirts, because we're going to restore trust in our democracy. And we're going to fulfil the repeated promises of Parliament to the people and come out of the EU on October the 31st. No ifs or buts. And we will do a new deal, a better deal, that will maximise the opportunities of Brexit while allowing us to develop a new and exciting partnership with the rest of Europe, based on free trade and mutual support. I have every confidence that in 99 days' time we will have cracked it. But you know what? We aren't going to wait 99 days, because the British people have had enough of waiting. The time has come to act, to take decisions, to give strong leadership and to change this country for the better. And though the Queen has just honoured me with this extraordinary office of state, my job is to serve you, the people. Because if there is one point we politicians need to remember, it is that the people are our bosses. My job is to make your streets safer. And we're going to come in with another 20,000 police on the streets, and we start recruiting forthwith. My job is to make sure you don't have to wait 3 weeks to see your GP. And we start work this week with 20 new hospital upgrades and ensuring that the money for the NHS really does get to the front line. My job is to protect you or your parents or grandparents from the fear of having to sell your home to pay for the costs of care. And so I am announcing now, on the steps of Downing Street, that we will fix the crisis in social care once and for all with a clear plan we have prepared to give every older person the dignity and security they deserve. My job is to make sure your kids get a superb education wherever they are in the country, and that's why we have already announced that we're going to level up per pupil funding in primary and secondary schools. And that is the work that begins immediately behind that black door. And though I am today building a great team of men and women, I will take personal responsibility for the change I want to see. Never mind the backstop, the buck stops here. And I will tell you something else about my job. It is to be Prime Minister of the whole United Kingdom. And that means uniting our country, answering at last the plea of the forgotten people and the left behind towns by physically and literally renewing the ties that bind us together, so that with safer streets and better education and fantastic new road and rail infrastructure and full fibre broadband, we level up across Britain with higher wages, a higher living wage, higher productivity. We close the opportunity gap, giving millions of young people the chance to own their own homes and giving business the confidence to invest across the UK. Because it is time we unleashed the productive power, not just of London and the South East, but of every corner of England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. The awesome foursome that are incarnated in that red, white, and blue flag, who together are so much more than the sum of their parts, and whose brand and political personality is admired and even loved around the world for our inventiveness, for our humour, for our universities, our scientists, our armed forces, our diplomacy, for the equalities on which we insist, whether race or gender or LGBT or the right of every girl in the world to 12 years of quality education, for the values we stand for around the world. Everyone knows the values that flag represents. It stands for freedom and free speech and habeas corpus and the rule of law, and above all it stands for democracy. And that is why we will come out of the EU on October the 31st, because in the end, Brexit was a fundamental decision by the British people, that they wanted their laws made by people that they can elect and they can remove from office. And we must now respect that decision and create a new partnership with our European friends, as warm, as close, and as affectionate as possible. And the first step is to repeat unequivocally our guarantee to the 3.2 million EU nationals now living and working among us. And I say directly to you, thank you. Thank you for your contribution to our society. Thank you for your patience. And I can assure you that under this government, you will have the absolute certainty of the right to live and remain. And I say next to our friends in Ireland and in Brussels and around the EU, I am convinced we can do a deal without checks at the Irish border, because we refuse under any circumstances to have such checks, and yet without that anti-democratic backstop. And it is, of course, vital at the same time that we prepare for the remote possibility that Brussels refuses any further to negotiate. And we are forced to come out with no deal, not because we want that outcome, of course not, but because it is only common sense to prepare. And let me stress that there is a vital sense in which those preparations cannot be wasted. And that is because under any circumstances, we will need to get ready at some point in the near future to come out of the EU customs union and out of regulatory control.
Next we have coming up is Boris Johnson's speech to Parliament. And he's on fire. He's talking about, you know, the Brexit stuff and take UK out of it, whether they have an agreement or not. So he's going to put the European Union into a corner to where they're going to have to either make a deal with him, or they're leaving anyway. So here we go with Boris Johnson speaking to the first time before the Parliament of the United Kingdom.
Statement, the Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, with permission, I shall make a statement on the mission of this new Conservative government. But before I begin, I'm sure the whole House will join me in paying tribute to my right honourable friend, the member for Maidenhead, for all she has given to the service of our nation, from fighting modern slavery to tackling the problems of mental ill health. She has a great legacy on which we shall all be proud to build. And our mission is to deliver Brexit on the 31st of October for the purpose of uniting and re-energising our great United Kingdom and making this country the greatest place on earth. And when I say the greatest place on earth, I'm conscious that some may accuse me of hyperbole. But it is useful to imagine the trajectory on which we could now be embarked. By 2050, it is more than possible that the United Kingdom will be the greatest and most prosperous economy in Europe, at the centre of a new network of trade deals, which we have pioneered with the road and rail investments we are making and propose to make now, the investment in broadband and 5G. Our country will boast the most affordable transport and technological connectivity on the planet by unleashing the productive power of the whole United Kingdom, not just of London and the South East, but of every corner of England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, we will have closed forever the productivity gap and seen to it that no town is left behind ever again, no community ever forgotten. Our children and grandchildren will be living longer, happier and healthier lives. And our kingdom in 2050, thanks, by the way, to the initiative of the previous Prime Minister, will no longer make any contribution whatsoever to the destruction of our precious planet brought about by carbon emissions, because we will have led the world in delivering that net zero target. We will be the home of electric vehicles, cars, even planes, powered by British-made battery technology, being developed right here, right now. We will have the free ports to revitalise our coastal communities. A bioscience sector liberated from anti-genetic modification rules. Blight-resistant crops that will feed the world, and the satellite and Earth observation systems that are the envy of the world. We will be the seedbed for the most exciting and most dynamic business investments on the planet. Our constitutional...
Order, I apologise for interrupting the Prime Minister. There's far too much noise in this chamber. And far too many members who think it's all right for them to shout out their opinion at the Prime Minister. Well, let's be clear, it isn't. The statement will be heard and there will be ample opportunity, in conformity with convention and as established by me over the last decade, for colleagues to question the Prime Minister. But the statement will be heard, and it will be heard with courtesy. The Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, may I applaud your intervention, and I think there's also far too much negativity by the potential. I think you will agree, Mr. Speaker, because our constitutional settlement, our United Kingdom, will be firm and will be secure. Our union of nations beyond question. Our democracy robust. Our future clean, green, prosperous, united, confident and ambitious. And that is the prize, and that is our responsibility in this House of Commons to fulfil. And to do so, we must take some immediate steps. And the first is to restore trust in our democracy and fulfil the repeated promises of Parliament to the people by coming out of the European Union and doing so on October the 31st. I and all ministers are committed to leading on this date, whatever the circumstances, and to do otherwise would cause a catastrophic loss of confidence in our political system. It would leave the British people wondering whether their politicians could ever be trusted again to follow a clear democratic instruction. I would prefer us to leave the EU with a deal. I would much prefer it. I believe that it is possible even at this late stage, and I will work flat out to make it happen. But certain things need to be clear. The withdrawal agreement negotiated by my predecessor has been three times rejected by this House. Its terms are unacceptable to this Parliament and to this country. No country that values its independence and indeed its self-respect could agree to a treaty which signed away our economic independence and self-government as this backstop does. A time limit is not enough. If an agreement is to be reached, it must be clearly understood that the way to the deal goes by way of the abolition of the backstop. For our part, we are ready to negotiate in good faith an alternative, with provisions to ensure that the Irish border issues are dealt with where they should always have been in the negotiations on the future agreement between the UK and the EU. I do not accept the argument that says these issues can only be solved by all or part of the UK remaining in the customs union or in the single market. The evidence is that other arrangements are perfectly possible and are also perfectly compatible with the Belfast or Good Friday Agreement, to which we are of course steadfastly committed. My team and my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for exiting the European Union, are ready to meet and talk on this basis to the Commission or other EU colleagues whenever
wherever they're ready to do so. And for our part, we will throw ourselves into these negotiations with the greatest energy and determination and in a spirit of friendship. And I hope that the EU will be equally ready and that they will rethink their current refusal to make any changes to the withdrawal agreement. If they do not, we will of course have to leave the UK without an agreement under Article 50. The UK is better prepared for that situation than many believe. But we are not as ready yet as we should be. In the 98 days that remain to us, we must turbocharge our preparations to make sure that there is as little disruption as possible to our national life. And I believe that that is possible with the kind of national effort that the British people have made before and will make again. And in these circumstances, we would, of course, have available the £39 billion in the withdrawal agreement to help deal with any consequences. I have today instructed the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster to make these preparations his top priority. I have asked the Cabinet Secretary to mobilise the civil service to deliver this outcome should it become necessary. And the Chancellor has confirmed that all necessary funding will be made available. I will also ensure, £4.2 billion has already been allocated, I will also ensure that preparing for leaving the EU without an agreement under Article 50 is not just about seeking to mitigate the challenges, but also about grasping the opportunities. This is not just about technical preparations, vital though they are. It is about having a clear economic strategy for the UK in all scenarios, something in which the Conservative Party has always led the way. And it's about producing policies which will boost the competitiveness and the productivity of our economy when we are free of EU regulations. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, we will begin right away on working to change the tax rules to provide extra incentives to invest in capital and research. We will now be accelerating the talks on those free trade deals, and we will prepare an economic package to boost British business and lengthen this country's lead, which seems so bitterly resented by the benches opposite. Lengthen this country's lead as the number one destination in this continent for overseas investment, a status that is made possible at least partly by the diversity, the talent and the skills of our workforce. And Mr. Speaker, I also want therefore to repeat unequivocally our guarantee to the 3.2 million EU nationals now living and working among us. I thank them for their contribution to our society and for their patience, and I can assure them that under this government they will have the absolute certainty of the right to live and remain. Mr. Speaker, I want to end by making clear my absolute commitment to the 31st October date for our exit. Our national participation in the European Union is coming to an end, and that reality needs to be recognised by all parties. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, today there are very many brilliant officials, UK officials, trapped in meeting after meeting in Brussels and Luxembourg, when they could be better deployed in their They're deploying their talents in preparing to pioneer new free trade deals or promoting a truly global Britain. And I want to start unshackling our officials to undertake this new mission right away. So,
it's about all we can do tonight with that. So thank you very much for listening.